Hi, this is Lisa. I'm a co-host on Your College Bound Kid, and I'm super excited today to be with Dr. Lewis Newman, who is the author of a book called Thinking Critically in College, The Essential Handbook for Student Success, which is going to be coming out soon. And we're really excited to have Dr. Newman talk to us about this topic of how students can be successful in college, because although this is your college-bound kid, we don't want to just drop your kid off at the gates of campus and then say good luck to you and never, you know, intervene or give them any advice again. And Dr. Newman is a person with a lot of experience in academia. He was the former dean of academic advising and the associate vice provost for undergraduate education at Stanford University. And then before that, he was the John M. and Elizabeth W. Musser Professor of Religious Studies at Carleton College. So he has two different institutions and a wealth of experience, and I can't wait to hear what he has to tell us. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Newman.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
One thing I always like to do is to ask people to tell our listeners how they came to do what they're doing. You know, what was their career development, all the twists and turns, because I think it's really helpful for people to be constantly reminded that we're usually not a straight arrow from one destination to the other.
For sure. Yeah, my case might be a little closer to the straight arrow.
Well, there you go.
But you never know. So maybe I'm unusual in a different way than mm-hmm. some people. But I think from the time that I was in maybe high school, but for sure by the time I was in college, I think it had sort of become clear to me that I wanted to go on and become a college professor. I think that was kind of my dream job. And I loved studying. I loved being in college. It was exciting to me to think about the prospect of continuing to just learn and study and write and teach. And so I kind of got on that path pretty early on. So when I was an undergraduate, I studied, I double majored actually in philosophy and Hebrew. I then went on and did some graduate work at Brandeis for a year. I went on and then came back to the University of Minnesota where I had been an undergrad, did a master's degree in philosophy, spent a year studying in Israel related to my interest in Jewish studies, came back and did a PhD at Brown. And when I finished that in 1983 and went on the job market, I was fortunate enough to get a job at Carleton College, which is a wonderful institution. I hope your listeners know about it. And I was delighted both because it's a great place and also because it was in Minnesota where I had grown up and where much of my family still lived. And I stayed there for 33 years because it was just a wonderful place to teach. I had great students and terrific colleagues, and I can say more about Carleton maybe later in the podcast. And I then continued at Carleton for my whole career for 33 years. At a certain point, late in that time, I moved into administrative work and became one of the associate deans of the college at Carleton with responsibilities for overseeing the advising program, among other things. And that then became a kind of stepping stone to the position at Stanford that you mentioned, where I was in charge of the undergraduate advising program at Stanford. And I stayed there for 6 years and just retired at the end of last academic year back in July. So that's my career trajectory in a nutshell.
Wow.
Not too many twists and turns, honestly. But,
wow.
But it's been a very rewarding career, I'll say that.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. And then you retired and you just like threw down a book, you know, just wrote a book. And here we are promoting the book that is written and is really wonderful. So you're a person who likes to keep busy, I can tell.
I do like to keep busy, actually. I will say this. I started thinking about the book about 10 years ago, actually. I can say more about that. But it's taken me a long time to write the book and get it out. But I'm delighted that it's available now. Actually, it has come out as of just a few weeks ago officially. Oh, so
fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. That's even better. So tell us more about 10 years ago, what prompted you to think about writing this book?
For sure. Well, it was actually a very specific event. It's not usually the way this works, but in this particular case, I tell this story actually at the very beginning of the introduction to the book. I had a particular student at that time at Carleton. This was one of my last years of teaching before I moved into full-time administrative work. It was a class in which students had to do research projects. And as I always did, I had students give presentations on their projects to the rest of the class toward the end of the quarter. And they did those orally. I gave them guidelines for how to do a good oral presentation, and I videotaped them, which I always did. And then I would sit down with each student and look at the video of their presentation so that I could give them feedback. And there was one particular instance where a student and I were sitting and looking over her video and talking, and I said, "You know, Rachel, this was just a great presentation. You did terrific research. You organized it well. You presented it well. It would have been just that much better had you begun the presentation by articulating the questions you were asking, so that all that great information would have fallen into place. We would all have understood what questions your research was answering." And she kind of perked up. And so I said, "Well, you know, anytime you read anything, you ought to be asking yourself, like, what questions was the author trying to answer when they wrote this?" And she got even more interested and kind of leaned in. And I said, "Well, okay, so, you know, like every time you look at a syllabus for a course, you should ask yourself, like, what are the questions this course is designed to address? And why might the professor have put the course together in this particular way to explore those questions?" And by this point, she was kind of dumbstruck, and she looked back at me in this way that I will never forget. And she said, I should mention, she was a senior by this point. She
I
said,
know, I know.
"Why has nobody ever told me this before?" And I thought to myself, "Well, geez, why haven't we told you this before? Like, why couldn't we tell every incoming college student, like, these are the kinds of questions you need to be asking yourself. This is the kind of analysis your professors are going to expect you to do. You may not have had to do this in high school, but you're certainly going to have to do it in college. This is what it looks like, and this is how to do it." And so I began thinking about why there isn't such a book, and I began to look around and look at all the other college prep books out there, and there are dozens of them, as you probably know. And a lot of them say a lot of the same things, right? They all say, "Learn how to take good notes, go to your professor's office hours, be sure to go to class, get enough sleep, learn how to get along with your roommate, learn how to manage your time." All of those things are great, right? All good advice. But none of them would have helped Rachel know that she needed to ask articulate her questions at the beginning of her presentation so that we would know how to understand what she was talking to us about. Right? So that's the book that I wrote. And I'm delighted that it's available now for students. I hope it's used by college students in incoming classes and maybe even high school students as they're preparing to go to college.
Yeah, I mean, that moment that you had with her was just one of those moments where you kind of step back and you twist the situation a little bit and you see it from a whole different perspective and you see like, oh, of course, this has been so obvious. It's like that all along. You know, we all have these like implicit rules of how we teach and how we go to school and no one ever makes them explicit. And that's what I love about this book. And as I told you in our pre-meeting, like I really needed you in 1987. When, as a, you know, kind of badly educated Missourian, I hit the University of Chicago. And that was a rough transition. And I think I figured some of this stuff out the hard way. But it would have been so nice to have someone tell me the easy way right up front.
Well, thank you. A lot of students, when I talked with students in the process of working on the book, and I did talk with a lot of students to try to make sure that the kind of advice I was giving was the advice that would be helpful to them and have them reflect out loud on what was their transition to college like and what did they need to know that maybe nobody had told them. And many of them, as I gave them pieces of my book to look at and give me feedback on as I was drafting it, you know, a lot of them said very similar things, like, "I really wished I'd had this book when I started. It would have made life a lot easier." So my hope is that other people will feel that way as well. But I will tell you also, it also embarrassed me a little bit, to be honest, which is, like, why had I never said these things to students? Why had I always just made the assumption that students either knew them already or students would kind of pick this up by osmosis somehow by just taking our classes? You know, we all these faculty members design courses. We think we know what we're doing. We think we know what we're teaching, and we give students feedback on their work, and we think that they'll learn how to think and how to write and how to communicate just by going through their courses. And that's sometimes people do, and sometimes that's the hard way to learn, and sometimes students don't quite get it, like Rachel, who
Right.
was doing very well, as a matter of fact, but she had never had anybody kind of step back and say to her, so this is what it really takes. Like, this is how you think critically about the material. And this is the kind of approach that's going to be most effective. So that's what prompted me to write the book. And it's a little odd that it came out years after I quit teaching, but there you go.
Well, you know, you used all of that experience and it gelled, right? It gelled into this brilliant book, and it's going to help a lot of people I know.
Well, I said to my wife as I was working on it, I did my best to create it in a conversational way so that it would feel like I was talking to students, which of course I had a lot of experience doing for a lot of years. And I tried to keep that kind of very casual conversational tone throughout the book.
Yeah, no, and I think it is really accessible to students. When I read it, I was really impressed by how warm and friendly and inviting the book was. You know, sometimes I think people feel a little bit embarrassed or ashamed, like, how did I not know this? Or they, you know, but your book kind of takes all of that away, and you sort of invite them to see behind the curtain of what goes on in academia. And I think just having that knowledge can help them understand college so much more. So I think it's great. So, you know, I know that you have lots of experience with students, and I bet you have some suggestions for students and families on the first step of the journeys before they even get to colleges, selecting where they go to college. What are some of your thoughts about that?
Oh, for sure I do. And I've had occasion over the years to talk with students about these things and with prospective college students about them. I think one of the problems for many students and their families at this stage is that they're shopping for a product, essentially, a college to attend, and there's no consumer reports to go to. You know, there's no way to know exactly what it is that you're buying or even what features matter. It's not like buying a new pair of running shoes or a new appliance. People don't know what they're looking for or what they're looking at or how to evaluate the strengths or weaknesses of any particular college. You know, so what I like to say to students, for starters, is, again, with some assumptions, if we're talking about a four-year college, which in most cases is the case, a lot of things are going to be pretty similar, and that's part of what makes this difficult. Every college is going to require you to take some kind of general education requirements, probably a writing course, maybe foreign language, maybe some other kind of math science courses. They're going to be what we call distribution requirements or general education requirements. Every college is almost certainly also going to require you to major in something, and maybe they'll also require or encourage you to minor in some other field. Those are all basics, pretty much the same across most institutions. Most institutions will have lots of extracurricular opportunities, of things to get involved in, clubs and sports and the school newspaper and a whole range of other things that students can do with their time outside of class. And that's going to be largely the same at most institutions. So there's a lot of similarity, right? And at the same time, there are differences. And some of these differences matter. Some of these are not going to be surprises to your listeners. Size, colleges range widely from very small to enormous. Size makes a difference. Big universities are very different places from small liberal arts colleges. And as you noted earlier, Lisa, I've now spent time at both. Carleton is a small liberal arts college, only undergraduates, only 2,000 students. As opposed to Stanford, which is a very large research-focused institution with about 7,000 undergraduates and about 15,000 students overall, with a med school and a law school and a business school and a whole range of other schools apart from the schools that undergraduates go to. Location it matters. Carleton is in a small town, 45 minutes south of Minneapolis-St. Paul, in a small farming community, basically, Northfield, as opposed to a place like Palo Alto or a great big city like New York. Each school has its own culture, and those things are worth taking seriously. what kind of environment is this? Schools have different kinds of academic advising programs, and it's worth looking into those because they matter, I think. I say that not only because I ran an academic advising program.
But because they actually matter.
they really do matter because basically every student at every single student who goes through college at some point, often frequently, needs some advice about how to navigate the institution, how to make choices about courses, about majors, about you get sick and all of a sudden you've missed a week of class and you're trying to figure out, should I drop the class? Should I change my grading options? Should I just power through and stick with it? What do I do? You know, there are all these questions that come up and you don't know what to do because you've never had to make those choices before. So those are all times when advisors, if they're good, can be extremely helpful. You want to know about faculty availability. You want to know how many office hours do faculty have and how accessible are they? How much time do they spend with undergraduates? By the same token, I think there are a lot of things that people pay attention to that probably really don't matter, right? A lot of students, when they come to a college to look, take a campus tour, right? And the campus tour is always led by a current student. And sometimes that student is a really good tour guide and really engaging and really, you're just kind of smitten because the tour is so effective, right? And they do such a great job of selling the school, right? And sometimes the tour guide is dreadful. I remember going with my son at one point it was actually Penn, University of Pennsylvania. And we got a dreadful tour guide who barely made eye contact with us. And it was so ineffective. And, you know, it's hard not to be influenced by those things. And yet, if you think about it rationally, how good the tour guide is and how good the school is, I have nothing to do with one another. but you're influenced by that. So I would encourage people as one bit of advice, just ignore that. Just ignore that, you know, your impression of the tour. Lots of students will go to an individual class session. You get a chance to sit in on a class for a day. And again, you know, you might get something out of that, watching the students and the faculty or whatever. But, you know, that's just one course out of probably hundreds or thousands that are being offered. It's not necessarily representative. That particular day isn't even necessarily representative of how that course is going to be over the course of the quarter or the term. You know, those things are just not very useful metrics for evaluating a college. And yet people are often swayed by them in ways that I think don't matter. So I would say, here are some of the things you can do that actually do matter, in addition to looking at the advising program, which I think is a really key piece. That you can do your homework, and there are metrics. So there is something called that goes in by the name NESSE, NSSE. The National Survey of Student Engagement. This is a very widely used survey that students at hundreds, if not thousands of institutions across the country take. And the data is aggregated, but individual institutions will get their own scores on how students evaluate their own education at the institution that they're attending. And you can ask the people in your admissions offices, I want to see what your NESSE scores are. I want to know what your current students think about the education they're getting here, because that's going to tell you a lot. There are surveys that are regularly done of faculty by organizations. The Higher Education Research Institute at UCLA does one fairly often, and faculty at institutions across the country take these surveys and talk about their own experiences as faculty at these institutions. And you want to be at a place where your faculty are happy, not where they're frustrated by the institution, and where they don't feel supported, or they don't feel well compensated, or they don't feel like they have the opportunities to do their research or to grow in their teaching and so forth. You know, institutions often do surveys of their alumni, and you want to know what those alumni have to say about the institution, and how devoted they are to it, and how well they felt their education served them. Ask for those data from the institutions, and you'll get a much better snapshot of how well the school is really doing than any of the other things that people mostly pay attention to. So my biggest piece of advice is do your homework, gather that kind of information. And if a school isn't willing to share it with you, That's a pretty significant red flag, I would say.
Right. Yeah. No. And so the Nessie and those things, they're not available online. Like, there's not like a database that you can go to. You have to ask your individual institution, maybe talk to the research office, things like that.
I think that's what you'd have to do. There are, I think, online aggregated data from around the country, which would tell you overall, like, what are students saying about their education. But I don't think you can get it broken down by institution in a way that's publicly available. I think the institution would have to release that information to you. Whether they would do that or not, I can't say, but
Right.
certainly I think it's worth asking.
No, I think that's great. It's a really it's like an insider tip that people who haven't served their career in higher education wouldn't necessarily know about. But these are very important metrics and can really tell you a lot. So thank you for pointing those out. I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of admissions offices getting requests for
I may become a
the
very unpopular person very quickly, but that's okay because I do think it's good advice. I will throw in one more, which is really easy and something you can find out on your own very, very easily. Many institutions, both Carleton and Stanford among them, these days have something called a learning and teaching center, or a center for teaching excellence, or they go by different names. But these are organizations within the institution that are designed to provide ongoing support and training and help to faculty in a whole range of ways. And at Carleton, I could tell you some of the things that we did. I was at one point the director of our Learning and Teaching Center before I went into full-time administrative work. And those learning and teaching centers can be very powerful engines for faculty learning and sharing and creating community among faculty so that faculty feel like they're growing. Because a lot of young faculty get to an institution right out of grad school. They really haven't had much experience teaching. They need help
Right.
getting their feet on the ground. And if the institution cares about good quality teaching, they will have invested in creating a robust learning and teaching center to support their faculty. If they don't have one, likely that those faculty are not getting some of the help that they probably need. And if they do have one,
Right.
you want to know how well supported it is and how often faculty use it, and talk to the person who runs that center and find out what kinds of support they offer faculty, because that's a big factor. You want to be in a place where faculty are learning and constantly growing. And a learning and teaching center is often where that happens.
Yeah, that's so interesting because I've often thought, people are subject matter experts and then they're, put in this position where they're supposed to teach. And teaching is much better than I do. Like, it's a skill, it's an art form. There are a lot of different factors to it. And I don't think that probably a lot of these new faculty are given training in their graduate programs, with that. I know I was a graduate assistant, and they just kind of gave me, a class and said, go. I always felt like a little bit of an imposter. I'm
Right.
doing my best here, but I don't know if I'm doing it right.
A lot of graduate students are put in that position. I will say this: these days, it's more and more common, I think, for institutions to have. Sometimes that learning and teaching center is really more focused on the graduate students
Right.
who are teaching assistants for big courses than they are even on the full-time or regular faculty. But even then, I think it's a real benefit if that exists at an institution. And we're not just sort of throwing people in the deep end and saying swim and figure out how to teach.
Yeah, no, those are really amazing tips. And I don't think that's something people are going to hear from other places. So thank you for sharing all of that.
Sure.
I'm definitely going to encourage my students to start doing this now. So in the book, I mean, one of the big pieces of your book is developing and using your critical thinking skills. So can you tell us more, like, what are critical thinking skills? And then I think you have like certain questions that you organize them around. Tell us more about that.
Sure. I do. There's a whole field out there of people who study and teach critical thinking. And I don't presume to be an expert. My background is in religious studies. I have a lot of experience teaching and a lot of experience in administration. But I didn't ever study critical thinking formally. So what I began to do, based on that early story that I told a bit ago about my contact with this particular student, is I began to think more about what is it that students really need to know how to do to succeed in college from an academic kind of intellectual standpoint. I began to sort of sort through my own experience. What is it that I expected students to know how to do? What did my assignments expect them to do? And I began to talk to colleagues in other fields and began to formulate what I thought of as the essential critical thinking skills for college. Right? So I'm not going to claim that this is everything that critical thinking encompasses everywhere that we use our critical thinking skills. But I will say that I think, having now tested this with a number of different people, I think it's a pretty good summary of what we expect in college. And I boiled it down to basically four very, very broad, but four general kinds of things that we want college students to know how to do. Number one, explore context. So let me lay them all out and then I'll come back and okay. elaborate a bit. Number one is explore context. Number two is consider alternatives. Number three is weigh evidence. And number four is examine implications and new applications. I put those things together. So circling back, exploring context can mean a lot of things. You read something that's given to you. There's a lot of context. There's a historical context. This thing didn't just drop out of the sky. It was written at some particular time, at some particular place, by some particular person or people who lived some kind of life and whose life and circumstances may have influenced who they are, how they thought, how they approached their subject, why they even became interested in that subject. There are a whole range of ways in which context will help you understand and place the thing that you're looking at. So it gives you a perspective. You're not just reading this thing as if it's a voice coming out of the void at you, and you're just supposed to sort of read it disconnected from anything. You read it in connection with the context that you discover it came out of. And so you need to explore context in order to understand things. Second, considering alternatives. Like, think about interpreting a story or a poem, right? Or interpreting lab results if you're running an experiment. There's almost always more than one interpretation, more than one way of reading those results. And instead of just taking the first way that appears to you or that occurs to you, you want to always be looking for alternatives and weighing the merits of this way of reading it or interpreting it versus some alternative way. I like to call this, you know, with apologies to Robert Frost, you know, the road not taken, right? A famous poem that I hope your listeners know. If not, go check out your Robert Frost poems. But the road not taken is always the question of, so this was one way of looking at it or one way of interpreting it. What are the other possibilities that may not be right in front of me? But if I considered them, I would realize, well, you know, this one looked good, but maybe there's another one that's really better.
Right.
Or maybe I'll at least see the merits and shortcomings of the one I'm looking at more clearly if I see it in relationship to alternatives. So thinking about alternatives and considering them is also an important piece of critical thinking. Number three, weighing evidence. This is maybe in some ways the most important right. piece of critical thinking. Right? We don't take things at face value in academia. Right? If somebody makes a claim that something is true or something is likely, you want to know, well, why? What supports that? Right? I will add as a maybe bit of editorializing here. You know, we see this all around us all the time. You know, we see reports yes. about everything from vaccine effectiveness to election fraud or integrity, or, you know, politicians and other people make statements, advertisers make statements all the time about the effectiveness of their products. Like, do you just take that at face value, or do you stop and ask yourself, well, how do they know? Like, what have they tested it? Who tested it? Did the people who tested have a vested interest in convincing me because they stand to gain if we buy the product? You know, the example I use in the book is, you know, a study that was produced that suggested that sugar is not really very bad for your health. Well, it turns out that the sugar industry had a role in financing that particular piece of research. Well, you know, that should give you some pause when you listen, right? So you want to ask yourself always, what's the evidence and where is it coming from? And how reliable is it? How objective is it? How extensive is it? Right? All of those questions are kinds of critical thinking questions that we always want to be asking. And last but not least, what are the implications, right? If this is true, that whatever it is that I'm reading or whatever it is that I'm looking at, what else follows? Where does that lead? What other conclusions might I draw? Or similarly, if you get, and this happens a lot in college, you learn something, and then on the test, you don't get asked to reproduce exactly what you learned in the textbook or the lectures. You're asked to take something that you learned and apply it in some new context or in relationship to some new set of data or some new set of circumstances to prove that you really understood the theory or the idea that you were taught. And it's the ability to apply and see implications that is another piece of critical thinking. And so my book is basically built around those four: context, comparison, evidence, and implications. And I claim, and I think I'm basically on pretty solid ground here, that pretty much every college assignment you will ever see is going to ask you to do one and frequently more than one of those things. And so one of the whole chapters of the book includes examples of college assignments parsed with an eye to what are the critical thinking skills that you need in order to tackle this assignment effectively. And my goal is to help students learn what those are and then learn how they're going to show up in their assignments and what they need to do to do them in the ways that their faculty are likely to expect them to do them. So that's, in a nutshell, those are the kinds of critical thinking skills that I discuss in the book.
Yeah, when I read this, I was like, yes, this is exactly what we should be doing anytime we get some sort of problem that we need to solve or we, you know, get some new information or a new source. If you can teach students to systematically go through these four questions, I think that's going to just be a game changer for them. You know, and like I said, like, I think a lot of times people who turn out to be good students kind of maybe do this, just they figure it out on their own or it's just innate. But, you know, this is something that everyone can learn and that everyone can apply. And I have to agree with you. I feel like if everyone did learn this and apply this, we might not have some of the issues that we're having now. Because, you know, when you talk to people who have such disparate news sources, you know, in my clinical practice, I talk to all kinds of people. And one client will always bring, well, Lisa, did you hear about, you know, X, Y? I'm like, no, of course not. Because, I mean, you and I are on different, we are literally on, we have different versions of reality. And sometimes I'll even point out, well, that's not true. And here's why. But it's like, no, well, Tucker Carlson told me this, so it must be true. That kind of thing. And I'm just like, you know, there's not that critical thinking going on there.
Right. Well, and I'll just throw in, I mean, even to steer clear of all the very highly charged political stuff, right? Put all that aside, even.
Just period.
Every one of us throughout our lives is going to have to make decisions about things like our own medical care. So exactly. You have some sort of medical problem. You go to your doctor. They tell you, well, this treatment is available or this medication is available, right? You want to be able to ask and you hope to be able to get answers to how effective is it? How long has this drug been on the market? Right? What's your experience with it? You know, what tests have been, what trials have been done? Is this experimental? Right? You want to know evidence that it's going to be, that it's going to work for you, or you're going to have to make decisions about where to invest your money. And you want to know,
yes,
what's the track record of this particular investment? And what's the likelihood that I'm going to lose my money or make money, or that this is a worthwhile, right? Every decision we make, we want to make in a way that's based on some kind of evidence. Now, there are certain kinds of decisions you might make, you know, who I'm going to fall in love with and marry might be,
different kinds of evidence, right?
Different kinds of evidence. Maybe you rely more on your gut and less on, you know, on something objective. But the truth is that in a lot of decisions in life, we want to base, even in the decision on where to go to college, you want to base it on some kind of evidence. So begin by thinking about what kind of evidence is going to be meaningful and relevant.
Right.
You know, so I think these are skills that are useful really throughout our lives. And I think college is a great place to begin gaining them and honing those skills for the long term.
Right. You know, I think that, you know, also just kids neurodevelopmentally, they're in the space where they can start doing more abstract thinking as young adults, whereas, you know, maybe 15, 16, 14, it's kind of an uphill battle for some kids. You know, I think the thing that always strikes me is that, you know, human beings, we have to process information really quickly all the time. So we use heuristics like, well, you know, the last time I turned this corner, there was a tiger there. So I'm going to expect the tiger is going to be there the next time. And, you know, 85% of the time, that's right. But like, it's not based on logic. It's based on association. It's not based on evidence, right? It's not like I didn't take a study of how many tigers or how many corners, you know, in a 1 mile radius to, you know, make a predictive model. But this kind of, if people can start doing this in a systematic way, it takes them out of that kind of thinking. And it helps them realize what their kind of biases are and to be able to weigh evidence more effectively.
Right. Absolutely. I was like, one of the things I talk about in the book is what, as you will know as a psychologist, we call confirmation bias, right? We are all inclined, our brains seem to be wired in a way that we are inclined to pay attention to and believe things that reinforce prior beliefs. So, you know, if I come across information that challenges something I already believe, and especially if I believe it really strongly, I'm disinclined to trust it.
Right.
Right. It might well be true, but if it challenges me, I'm disinclined to trust it. And that's true of people right, left, and center. It's generally true about all human beings. And so one of the things that critical thinking in college is about is to help us confront our own biases and to help us realize that we may be exposed to points of view and evidence that will challenge things that we grew up believing or things that we were told, maybe even things that our parents told us. And you know, it can sometimes be unsettling. College education is not always comfortable. It's sometimes quite uncomfortable in exactly that way. And that's a good thing, we think, because it's teaching us to really pay attention to evidence and implications and not just to fall into the rut of continuing to believe whatever we were told sometime early in life.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I think that that is a great thing. And again, you know, even in like academia or science, there are these confirmation biases that highly trained, professional, educated people have. You know, I know in my field in psychology, depending on what you know, sort of school of philosophy of human behavior you come from, you tend to explain everything with that explanation in mind and kind of ignore all the other explanations. And over years of just talking to people, I realized that some things are true from all of them and nothing is totally true from any of them. But, you know, people spend their whole lives in one particular thing. So I think, you know, again, if you're constantly being rigorous with yourself and asking these questions, then you're going to be less likely to do that. I think, too, that the application and the new implications, it's like that's the secret sauce of creativity and progress, right? I mean, so if people can just start habitually doing that, I think we're going to see a lot of things happen and improve.
Yeah, I would hope.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that I had going for me going to the University of Chicago is I had an English teacher in my junior year of high school, and she would make us do these charts on every, like pretty much every word of every piece of literature that we read, where we had to make implications for self, to other, and to the world. And so I just became like very practiced at making these generalizations and implications. And I pretty much do that all day long as a therapist, quite honestly. And that is the only reason why I think I didn't fail out, because she just made us do it over and over and over and over until it was just, I would see any symbol and bam, I had three explanations of things it could do and different implications. And so I think that's really important.
Well, and the point is, and that example, Lisa, is really useful too, because actually those four things that I laid out sound pretty simple. And in a certain way they are, but it takes us a very long time to learn how to do them, to really train our minds to work that way as sort of second nature. Because as you said, you know, it's really easy for us to sort of just default to the theory that we know or the explanation that comes most readily to mind. And so in a certain way, it takes all of college and a long time beyond college often
yes.
of practicing these skills before we really, really get good at them. And so I think your example is great in the sense that the more you reinforce them and the more you're focused on them through your college education, the more you'll realize that, you know, even though your chemistry class and your history class and your political science class and whatever, you know, your physics class are all very different, in a certain way, the basics of training you to think about context and comparison and evidence and implications, those things are present throughout. And if you keep focusing on them and noticing the ways in which they keep coming up in different forms, in different fields, you're going to begin to sort of get that ingrained in you, and that those habits of mind will then become a part of who you are and how you think about everything.
Yeah, no, I think this is great. And I think even, you know, your book has a lot of more advice. And I think even if people just took these four questions and started practicing applying them, they'd be way ahead of the pack. You also have some other suggestions to promote student success. Can you outline a few of those?
Sure. I include in between these chapters that I really focused on critical thinking, what I call advice for the road ahead, which are just little 2 to 3 page tidbits of advice about how to approach your college education in general. And some of them are things like adopting a growth mindset. That's a concept that again, a lot of people in psychology are familiar with. Carol Dweck at Stanford, I think, pioneered the research on this. And basically what that means is simply, you know, we all face setbacks in life. And if every time you hit a setback, you feel discouraged and demoralized, and it reinforces for you a sense that you're incompetent, or you're failing, or you can't get it, or you don't know how to learn, or whatever negative message you draw from that setback, you're essentially shooting yourself in the foot. And if by contrast you develop a, oh gee, you know, I made a mistake, what can I learn from that? Next time I can learn to do better. And you look forward with a more positive attitude and recognize that setbacks are an essential and inevitable part of the learning process. You will use those setbacks as stepping stones to continue to grow and develop. So if you can focus on developing a growth mindset, it will serve you well throughout your college career. Another example, you know, I talk about joining a team. A lot of students are accustomed to trying to do things on their own, being independent learners, and there's nothing wrong with independence. But in college, there are a lot of times when you're going to be required to do group work, group projects. But even if you're not required to, you may well find that it's useful to join a study group and work together, because, you know, two minds are better than one, and three Exactly. or four minds are better than two. And it's not only that the collective brain power is useful, it's that sometimes when you're in a situation like that and you try to explain something to somebody else, the very process of trying Exactly. to say it out loud and then have somebody else say to you, well, I didn't quite understand what you meant by that, helps you clarify your own thinking. So there's actually a process of deepening your own learning just in the process of working it out together. So that's another little piece of advice, is that sometimes, you know, pay attention to the possibilities that come from working with others. Another example is a little piece that I call taking risks. So, you know, every student who comes to college has familiarity with English and history and and math and some science of various kinds and so on, right? Those subjects are all going to be taught in college, and you can sort of just gravitate to the things that you've already studied and the things that you know well and that you know you're good at. And that's not bad. You know, there's nothing, you know, you can get a great college education sort of playing it safe, if you will. But I encourage students in the book to take some risks, to move outside of your comfort zone, to try something new. At Carleton, early on, I came across, there's a piece of advice that supposedly some Carleton, an older student, had given to a younger student. I don't know if this actually happened or not, or if this was just a myth. But the piece of advice was, every term, take one course you're required to take, one course you'd love to take, and one course you never in a million years dreamed you'd take. And that last piece is the piece that a lot of students don't immediately gravitate to. They're worried about their GPA. They're worried about, you know, how am I going to do in this thing? I don't know anything about it. But that's often the place where your learning deepens the most. You expand your horizons. You discover that you're interested in things you never even knew you were interested in.
Exactly.
And college is a great opportunity for that. And I encourage students to seize that opportunity, because you're not going to get it again in quite the same way. You're never again likely to be in a place where at your doorstep you could take classes in subjects so diverse and taught by experts in those fields that, you know, are so easy to access. So I think that's an opportunity that college offers that I encourage students to take advantage of. So in any case, those are just some of the little tidbits of advice that I think, based on my own experience teaching and advising students over the years. Lots of students, for example, I taught religious studies, as I said, a lot of students looked at that and said, oh, religion. Oh, I went to Sunday school. I hated it. I'm not going to take a religion class. Not realizing that religious studies in college is nothing at all like Sunday school.
Right.
Right. And so in a way, they cut themselves off from the opportunity to learn things that they would have probably found really quite interesting. Anyway, so that's just one example.
Yeah, no, I think that those are all really great points. And again, you're making something explicit that, you know, is kind of implicit. Like, I'm so glad that people are talking about the growth mindset, and they've said, you know, there's a language around that, because I think, you know, a lot of times we feel like we're not supposed to make any mistakes. We're supposed to be perfect. And if we're not perfect, then we're doing it wrong. And then you're trying to hide that. There's shame, rather than saying like, oh, this is a great opportunity to learn. Like, we know that people learn things more effectively after they've made a mistake and then they correct it, right? That's how it sticks in your brain. We know all these things, but yet, like, in our society, like, it's not necessarily encouraged to kind of explore, to talk about that. The same with the group work, you know, like, you have to be okay with being uncomfortable and having someone challenge what you say. And you might be like, yeah, you know, you're right, or no, you're wrong, and here's why. But it pushes you to, that discomfort pushes you to further elucidate your point.
Exactly. I used to have this conversation, just to piggyback on that for a second, when students would come to me who got, you know, a C or a D even on a paper that I'd assigned. And they were distraught. And, you know, I would try to say to them, look, you know, if you could get an A on every assignment or an A in every course, the minute you walked in here, like, we would just hand you your diploma and tell you to move on. Like, because there's nothing more for you to learn. You know it all. Right. The point of college is that, of course, it's going to be challenging. You're almost certainly going to work harder to get top grades in college than you had to in high school, unless you went to an extremely, extremely rigorous high school, and some students will have. But by and large, college is going to be more challenging intellectually than high school was. And you have to assume that you're likely to work harder to get the same grades as you got in high school. And that's a good thing. That's what you're paying for. You're paying for an education.
Right. You're paying to get challenged. And if it, like, our culture doesn't like, and I think this is a, you know, I could go on for hours about this and how it's affecting teen mental health, you know, but the fact that we're just like, oh, you need to get straight A's and take all the APs and be the captain of, like, the World Galactic Peace Society or whatever it is, that crazy thing that we're now expecting. Yep. You know, it's just, no one says like, well, yeah, you know, there was this time when I tried playing the trumpet and I learned I was really terrible at it, and that's why I play the drums now. You know, like, that's a perfectly acceptable course of events, but maybe not, you know, the way that people view it in college admissions all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I definitely have to say that, you know, even as an adult, I find that if I'm put in situations where I'm forced to learn things that I don't want to learn, it's amazing. So I'm helping out at my son's school. He's in fifth grade, and after school they have this science and math and technology interest group. And so I'm basically there as crowd control, because everyone else is scientists or computer programmers. And I'm just like, where are you going? And no, you can't go to the bathroom again. Right. But I, you know, I'm starting to learn through osmosis about coding and, math. And it's just, you know, I learned the other day that I think like Python only has 33 words and that it knows, and yet you can build the most amazing things with that. And my mind was just blown. You know, it made me want to start learning those words. I think even as an adult, we have to challenge ourselves sometimes and put ourselves in places where it's not our area of expertise.
Absolutely.
So what do you think are the most common mistakes that college students make, and what could they do to not make those mistakes?
Well, one of them you just touched on. I think one of the mistakes is perfectionism. I think assuming that the goal is to kind of assemble a perfect record or perfect GPA is a trap. And I think that students fall into that trap really easily. And in part, it's because of social pressures. In part, it's because of the intensity of the college admissions process itself and how competitive it has become, especially at certain top schools. So in a way, I think students have been kind of socialized to feel like the better they perform, the more successful they're going to be. And over again in college, I came across students who were just devastated the first time they failed at something, because they thought their life was over, basically. I mean, I thought they just had never experienced that before, and they... And it sort of shattered their sense of self-worth or their sense of self-esteem, because they expected themselves to be able to do it perfectly. And if you could shed that and just accept your own humanity and the fact that everybody makes mistakes. I used to say to students sometimes, you know, even the best professional baseball players ever, you know, don't bat 1,000. You know,
no,
like,
they do not.
Far from it. You know, a really good baseball player, and I'm not a big baseball fan personally, but a really great baseball player is in the mid to high 300s, right? That's a great average.
Right. Like,
which means that you strike out a lot. And, you know, like that's everybody does, even the very best people do. So, you know, keep that mindset in mind. And I think it helps you both in terms of mental health, but also in terms of just your attitude toward learning. And so that's one thing that I think students often make it harder on themselves by not looking at that in a more realistic way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a huge problem. And I suppose, you know, college admissions certainly plays a large role in the whole process. You know, I think that kids feel like it's sort of the presumption is that everyone can go to Stanford and everyone can go to Harvard and you just have to work hard enough. And that's not really true, right? I mean, there's a lot of luck that goes into it, circumstance, who you know, what opportunities you might have had or might not have had. But people put the pressure on themselves as if those things didn't exist. And it was all about them and their ability and their hard work. And I think that does then, learning is not even important in that. Achieving is important. You know, that's, and if we could just get back to learning, I think kids would feel so much better.
I absolutely agree. And one other, talk about implications, one other implication of that, I think, or extension of that, has to do with the way people think about the purpose of college altogether. And I think increasingly students enter college, partly because of how expensive it is, enter college with a focus on what can I study that's going to get me a good paying job when I get out? And there's certainly nothing wrong with getting a good paying job. And I don't want to be interpreted in any way as suggesting that doesn't count. And particularly in many cases for students who are first generation college students, for whom their college is really a ticket to helping them and their families, move out of difficult circumstances into more comfortable circumstances. And that's a laudable goal, absolutely. And I also want to say that along with that, and I talk about this quite a bit in the book, that college is about learning how to think. Because the job that you think you're aiming for, you know, may be your first job out of college. It may not last that long. you may discover that that information that led to that job is obsolete before long. What you want to do is think about your college education as a ticket to jobs that don't even exist yet. Because you want to be trained and prepared to think in the ways that will enable you to do any job better than the other person who's applying for the same job, right? Because that's your competition. And what you want to do is use your college education as a way to prepare you for the future, for a life that's going to be successful and meaningful in the broadest possible way, not in a very narrowly focused career or job related way. And I think students often make the mistake of imagining that college is really only about career preparation. And I think, again, there are benefits to college, absolutely. There's lots of evidence that people who get college degrees have far higher lifetime earnings than people who don't. And at the same time, there's a lot more to college than just earning potential.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's sort of the intangibles that people, you can't measure, you know, your ability to think critically about a certain issue, like in a dollar sign or in any other kind of way. It's how you experience life and how you go through the world. And I think that is why taking things that you don't want to take and learning to think critically and to weigh evidence. I mean, that just, as you said, it helps in every aspect of your life, professionally, personally, you know, and hopefully like societally as well. But yeah, I think that what you touched on, I mean, so many people are thinking that college isn't worth it now because they're looking at maybe as a vocational track or the dollar signs. And our society isn't emphasizing this other piece, right? Of how do you think and how do you be a person and how do you go through the world and be able to face different challenges, whether they're professional or personal. And I really wish it, you know, we kind of started looking at that more.
Right. And I'll just, again, piggyback on that a bit by saying that also skews people's interest in college often toward subjects that look like they have very direct channels, right, into particular kinds of careers, right? So if you're interested in being a doctor, you want to major in biology. If you're interested in being a lawyer, you might want to major in political science, right? If you're interested in being a psychologist, you might want to major in psychology. Right? These are things that look very much like they are career tracks. Whereas, you know, philosophy doesn't immediately lend itself to how are you going to make a living as a philosophy graduate? Right? But the reality is that in fact, the kinds of thinking that you learn how to do in a philosophy class could end up being extremely helpful. And a lot of businesses are very interested in people who can think about ethics and who can think about implications.
Yes. Yes.
And who can think about comparing two ideas and two ways of looking at something and so forth. So the skills that you learn in those classes could turn out to be extremely useful and marketable if you thought about them that way, instead of just thinking narrowly about what subject leads to what kind of career. And I need to find something that's very career focused. I'll tell your listeners, I had an occasion with early on in my time at Stanford, I had little focus groups that I gathered of students because I wanted to learn about their experience and just get to know them. And it was one way of kind of getting acculturated to Stanford was I spent time over dinner with a lot of different students. And I had students say to me things like, you know, my parents have said, you know, you need to major in a STEM field, right? Science, technology, engineering, or math. You need to major in a STEM field or I'm not going to pay for your education. And I thought to myself, how sad that the parents are sort of constraining their children's choices in that way, because their idea is that this education is only going to pay off if you take a very particular kind of course of study. Whereas in fact, you know, you look at Stanford graduates who graduate in all sorts of other fields, they're all doing quite well. They all get jobs. They all, right? So, and that's, I don't want to be just Stanford specific, but it's also the case that, you know, whatever college you go to, whatever degree you get, there are going to be opportunities for you to use that in productive ways. And you need some help maybe to figure out how to build on what you've already done and what you know. But ask most people these days, ask most 30, 40, 50 year olds, like, what are you doing now and what relationship does it have to your college major? And the answer is almost always very little.
Yes.
Little connection. Right? I got here through some circuitous route that had very little to do with what I majored in. So I would encourage, maybe that's another mistake I would identify. Students too often assume that their major is their destiny, career-wise. And it's just not true.
Yeah. No, I think those are all great points. I mean, one of the smartest people, I moved to Chapel Hill a couple of years ago, that I have met was somebody was helping me in the shoe store. And he was a senior at UNC Chapel Hill. And he was killing it with all of his dental school applications and getting it everywhere. But he was a comparative literature major. And just because he loved it, but he also wanted to be a dentist. And so he took all the other, you know, prerequisites for dentistry. And, you know, I think that made him a really distinctive candidate, in addition to doing what he loved for 4 years. So I thought he was great. And the shoes were awesome. Added bonus.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I will tell you, I mean, one of the things that I did at Stanford was oversee the people who did pre-professional advising, particularly pre-med and pre-law advising. And they would say regularly to students that, you know, of course you need to take organic chemistry and all these math and physics classes and all the other things that medical schools expect you to have done before you apply to med school. But if you want to be a standout candidate, you know, you might also want to have taken art history, because the ability to look at things closely and being able to, that kind of visual acuity is really important as a doctor. Or you might want to have majored in psychology, because actually, you know, the ability to talk to people and understand them and relate to them is actually a pretty important part of being a doctor. And being able to talk about that on your med school application might actually set you apart from a lot of the other candidates who are just sort of mainstream, really good scientists.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So you bring up, you know, you talk to these Stanford students, and of course, I'm sure you spent a lot of years talking to Carleton students. So how do you find the two institutions to be different from each other? And what kind of student do you think would excel at each school?
Well, they're very different from one another to start with. I spent a much longer time. I should acknowledge first, I spent a much longer time at Carleton, mm-hmm. 33 years, mm-hmm. versus 6 years at Stanford. So obviously that's a big difference in my perspective on the two schools. And more importantly, even maybe, I was a faculty member at Carleton. I was an administrator without faculty status at Stanford. And that too gave me a different relationship to the mm-hmm. institution. So with those caveats, that context to keep in mind, I would say that, you know, Stanford is enormously, it's on an entirely different scale. I would say it's a more intense place, you know, as your listeners no doubt know.
Most difficult schools in the country to get into. So Stanford is a much, much larger institution. It's a much more complicated institution. It's also a much more selective institution. Carleton is selective, mm-hmm. for sure. One of the top liberal arts colleges in the country by any measure. Stanford, as your listeners probably know, has, I think, one of the most selective admissions processes in the country. Something like 4% of mm-hmm. applicants are admitted. So you're dealing with students who are extremely high-powered academically, very successful. Many of them have also done things outside of their academic work in high school that are extremely impressive. It's, I would say, a more competitive place in that sense, because you're comparing yourself as a student mm-hmm. to Olympic athletes and students who created a startup in high school and then sold it to Google or Facebook or something. You know, you're dealing with a different kind of student, often, who has done maybe more exceptional things. And so there's a lot more of that sense of, I need to keep up with the kid who lives down the hall from me, or my roommate even. At the same time, of course, Stanford faculty are world renowned. You've got Nobel Prize winners and Pulitzer Prize winners and academic superstars. I worked with students who studied with Condoleezza Rice and did, you know, work mm-hmm. on international relations with former Secretary of State. Well, you can't do that at Carleton or virtually any other place other than a Stanford or a Harvard or a Yale or one of the very major prestigious institutions that focuses on research. I would also say this is partly because of Stanford's expertise in computer science, and also partly, of course, because it's located in the center of Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. But there's much more of a STEM focus to students. A very high percentage of students at Stanford are majoring in engineering, and of those, a very, very high percentage major in computer science of one kind or another. So that's another factor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Carleton, by contrast, you know, it's smaller, it's a little more, it's more intimate. Your faculty are not as famous. They're probably, with a few rare exceptions, are not world-class researchers, but they've probably spent a lot more time thinking about their courses and about, about teaching and about the time. They spend probably more time on average with their undergraduate students than a typical Stanford faculty member would, because they're getting rewarded for being outstanding teachers as opposed to getting rewarded for the research that they do, or the research grant money that they bring in. And Stanford is quirkier. Stanford used to say that there was...
Really?
I'm saying Stanford, I beg your pardon. Carleton is quirkier.
Oh, that makes more sense.
Carleton is quirkier. There's, again, a famous sort of quip that may be true, it may be mythic, I don't know, that some Carleton student was once asked, what's a typical Carleton student like? And this person responded, a typical Carleton student is somebody who would be offended at the notion that there's such a thing as a typical Carleton student. And there's something to that, there's a way in which everybody kind of takes pride in their quirkiness and their individuality. So I don't know. Those are just some of the differences in the institutions, in the cultures of the institutions, in the kind of educational experience that a typical student, there is such a thing as a typical student, that a typical student would have at each institution. As you might be able to tell, I loved my time at Stanford. I had wonderful colleagues. I had wonderful students that I worked with. But I was a faculty member. I had a different relationship with Carleton, and I spent much longer there. I was shaped in a way by my experience in a small liberal arts college. I came to love that kind of education and that kind of institution. But I was also aware that students had opportunities. There were students who came in, and as first year, you know, freshmen at Stanford, they were doing research with doctors in the medical school on really cutting edge research, things you couldn't do at a small institution like Carleton. So there are pros and cons. And I would encourage your listeners to think clearly about how they most want to use their undergraduate experience, because research focused institutions and small liberal arts colleges are just very different in a lot of ways. And you're going to get a different kind of education, a fine education in both places, just a very different.
Just very different. Yeah. No, that's really great.
You talked about going to the University of Chicago, which I imagine likewise, you know,
it's more like Carleton, I think. Yeah.
You know, people who, you know, famous faculty and opportunities to do research with them perhaps, but a different kind of environment than a small place like Carleton, especially a small place like Carleton in a rural setting.
I imagine that Carleton would have been more supportive than I experienced the University of Chicago, you know, because there are just fewer students and the professors have closer relationships with them. And I think that's really important. But, you know, at the University of Chicago or Stanford, as you say, there are amazing faculty that if you are interested in research or working with them, they're there. And hopefully you can do it. So kind of just, I guess, each student has to figure out what's most important to them.
Absolutely. Just by way of one example, at Carleton, they had a policy, and I think it still exists throughout my time there, that students who were had a dining plan could take a faculty member to lunch for free anytime. So the college picked up the faculty members, the cost of the faculty members' lunch, if you ate with a student in one of the dining halls. And so I used to say
it was mutually beneficial, right?
Exactly. So I used to say to students, my very first day of class, my opening spiel with students included a lot of other information. And I would say, and by the way, you know, contrary to popular opinion, there really is such a thing as a free lunch, at least for Carlton, and you can give me a free lunch if you're willing to take me to the dining hall, and I'd be delighted to be invited to lunch with you someday. But, and that's, again, it was a way that the college encouraged that kind of close relationship mm-hmm. between faculty and students mm-hmm. that was really valuable for a lot of.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. Because it's, you know, the students don't have to pay for the professor. It encourages them to be, you know, to get to know them. And for professors, like, who doesn't want their lunch paid for, right? It's not like you're making zillions of dollars as a college professor. So that's important. You know, every little bit helps. So that's fantastic. What advice do you have for parents as their kids go through the process of applying for college and being at college?
Well, so I should start by saying I am a parent. I had two sons, mm-hmm. both went through college now some years ago. They're in their 30s now. But I would say this. I encourage parents to back off. I think a lot of parents, at least in my experience, want to micromanage their students' college application process, maybe even to micromanage their students' lives to some degree. But for sure, they're worried that their students aren't going to follow through. They're not going to do what they need to do. They're going to make bad choices, whatever. And I think that as a parent, it's a natural impulse to try to protect your kids from making mistakes. It's a natural impulse to look over their shoulders and sort of mm-hmm. protect them and see how they're doing and support them and encourage them and all that. And I also think that it's valuable to begin at this stage to encourage your student to take responsibility for their own process of admission mm-hmm. to college. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of steps. You obviously have to keep track of deadlines. You have to make sure that you get materials in and organized and all the rest. There's plenty to do, including financial aid applications often and a lot of other pieces, right? But if you trust your student to do that, it'll be the first step in trusting them when they mm-hmm. go off to college. Often if they're living away from home, especially, like, they're going to be on their own. And they're going to have to manage their own lives. They're going to have to meet their own deadlines. You're not going to be able to keep track of when all those college assignments are due and remind them of when they are. Like, you're going to have to let mm-hmm. them go. And this is a good time to start. So I would encourage parents to allow their students to stumble a little bit, to make mistakes, because I think, as we said earlier, that's often the way we learn, is by making mistakes. And they will probably learn much better by making the mistakes themselves than they will if you prevent them from making the mistake, and then they never really learn what they need to learn. So that's my strongest piece of advice for parents.
I think that's great advice. And I think parents have a hard time doing it because, again, it's that focus on perfectionism and achievement, right? Like, it feels like your kid doesn't have any room to make mistakes. So you better make sure they don't make any mistakes. And obviously that won't even work because they will find other ways to make mistakes because they're creative. But, you know, I think it's that tension. Like, we don't, I feel like in the way our culture is set up right now, we're not giving people the chance to just be human beings, make mistakes, learn from their mistakes. It's, that doesn't exist almost in a high schooler's life anymore. And so I think then parents are overcompensating and then everyone's resentful of everybody. And as you say, it's just kind of a mess. So very good advice. And I hope we can all keep that in mind. And I'm pointing at myself.
I want to be clear. It's not easy out there.
No.
I understand that. Having been a parent, it is not easy to let go. And that's a part of what I think is happening as we move through this transition. It's a huge transition for our children mm-hmm. when they go off to college. It's a huge transition for us when they go off to college as parents. Right. And so I encourage parents, whenever I had the opportunity to talk to them, to mm-hmm. Really let go and do your best to let them stand mm-hmm. on their own feet and make their own decisions and make their own mistakes if need be.
Right, right. No, that's fabulous. Well, as you may know, no guest on your College Bound Kid gets away without being put on the hot seat, where we ask you random questions in an effort to get to know you in a different light.
Okay, so, I'm ready. Go ahead.
My first question to you is, where would you like to travel to that you haven't been able to go to yet? What's on your bucket list?
Wow, that's really interesting. There are a lot of places. Truthfully, my wife and I were just talking about this, and we are planning a trip actually to one of those places that neither of us has been, which is Ireland, late this coming summer. I've been to Scotland, and I've been to England. I've never been to Ireland, and I have a sense that there's a lot to learn there. It's historically really interesting, and a beautiful place to travel. That's one place on my bucket list. I've also never been to India, which is another place I would love to go sometime again, partly because of its religious interest to me. But beyond that, I think it's just a place with extraordinary history and architecture and art and all that. So those are two of the places, I guess, on my
Oh,
bucket list.
well, those are two great places. I've been to India. I've never been to Ireland. My oldest daughter has been there twice because her two different choirs took her there. So I've paid for two trips to Ireland. I just haven't been able to go yet, but it's definitely on my bucket list for sure. And India is like an amazing and overwhelming, incredible, and in some ways terrible place for people who like quiet. But it's definitely a must visit kind of country, I think. All right. So what kind of books have you been reading lately, and what kind of book would you recommend that our listeners pick up, something that's like meaningful to you?
Interestingly, my wife and I also just had another short vacation, and I
Wow.
often get around to reading things that are not professionally things that I want to read for my own professional development on vacation. And this time I picked up a book by John Meacham, the historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author. This book is a fairly, maybe not his most recent book, but one of his more recent books anyway, called The Soul of America. And I thought it was a wonderful book. It talks about the struggle in our history between kind of the forces of fear and the forces of hope, as he lays it out. He talks about the roles of different presidents in different eras and the ways in which there were different kinds of threats or imagined threats that we faced, and the struggles that we had to sort of, I think the subtitle is something about the angels of our better nature. In any case, it's sort of trying to make the case that even though the country has gone through many eras in the past of sort of being pulled back toward prejudices and nativism and discrimination against minorities and so forth, that in fact there is another side of America which has always come out ahead ultimately, which is to be more inclusive and more generous and more compassionate, and to really live up to the ideals of our founding. Well, if a question about whether these were really the ideals of the founding fathers,
What we invite our d ideals of the ideals
our
of the founding
ideals of their
fathers.
ideals anyway, of the founding of the country. And in that sense, he makes a case for being hopeful about the future of America. I
Oh, I
find
should
it's
probably
an
read that
inspiring
book. I
book to
could
read.
use a little dose of hope from time to time. It's so interesting because I think, up until very recently, I just had this like sort of naive American view that everything's just going to get better. It's just going to keep getting better. And I mean, it probably will in the long run, but it's like progress is always like a curly Q, I think. And sometimes it goes back, and hopefully it's on that upward trajectory, most of the time. But it just was kind of shocking to me, midlife, like to realize that.
Yeah, well,
So.
that's what I found really interesting about the book, is that he is hopeful, but he's not naive. He's very clear about all the forces that hold us back from realizing, the full potential of American ideals about freedom and justice and so on. Anyway, that was my most
All
recent.
right. Well, that sounds like a very excellent suggestion. So now let's say for whatever reason, you could not be in academia, you couldn't be a professor, you couldn't be a dean. What other career would you do?
Well, that's interesting. I thought about that at various times. This one is maybe a little bit of a fudge of an answer, but there was a point at which I was in my last years at Carleton. As I said, I was a full-time administrator. I was one of the associate deans of the college. And by that point, it was pretty clear to me that I didn't really want to go back to full-time teaching. I had my faculty position. I was supposed to go back after a 3-year stint in the dean's office, and I was reaching the end of that time and realizing that I was really ready to quit teaching I'd loved it, but I was now really hooked on thinking about big administrative and institutional questions, mm-hmm. and I wanted to go on and do other things. And I started applying for jobs and as deans other places, because the only dean's job at Carleton I could have had was my boss's, and she wasn't leaving, so I couldn't apply that.
Right.
So I started looking elsewhere, and I kept trying to get jobs and kept not getting them, actually. And so I began to think about, well, what would I do? And I started thinking about nonprofit administration, particularly mm-hmm. College access work, those organizations that support first generation and low income students to get to college and then be successful once they're there. Mm-hmm. And I found that was really inspiring. I had had a lot of opportunities to work with Gen students at Carleton. And so I began to explore those options. And that would have been another career path. Mm-hmm. Last minute, mm-hmm. this job at Stanford opened up and I applied and I was fortunate enough to get it. But that was one possibility. But I think even if I hadn't gone into that exactly, I probably would have tried to use my administrative skills to do some other kind of nonprofit administration work, because basically what administrators do is solve problems all day. And I find that somehow, addressing problems, figuring out how to get people to work together to help solve them was something I enjoyed doing. And at the end of the day, when you could solve a problem, it sort of felt like a win. And that happened often enough that I felt like it was a really satisfying kind of work. So that was the direction that I was headed in, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have always thought that, and this is a much less elaborate answer than you have, that if I wasn't going to be a psychologist, I would want to be a chocolatier, because chocolate makes people happy instantly, and what I do takes years. And so then I actually ran into a chocolatier. She and I were moms together, and she's like, oh my God, my alternate career is to be a psychologist. So there you go.
That's really great. Somehow they're linked.
I
love it. Well, and I should tell you other maybe question I was expecting you might ask me, like, what's my favorite food or something. Chocolate is absolutely my favorite food.
So what made you happy right there
totally,
off the bat?
Totally a chocoholic. So I would be delighted if you became a chocolatier, actually.
Well, there's still time.
You
there's still
that
time.
Great stuff.
Yeah. Well, so thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was, you gave us so much amazing information, and I know it's going to be so helpful for our listeners. If they want to pick up a copy of your book, Thinking Critically in College, The Essential Handbook for Student Success. Now, you said it's out now. Where can they find it?
They can find it wherever they buy their books, on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or the site called Indie Pubs, which is another bookselling site. Or just go into your local bookstore if you have a local bookstore that you use and ask them to order it. It's available. And so you shouldn't have any trouble getting it.
Well, that's great. And I know whoever gets this book and reads it is going to really benefit from it. And so I appreciate so much that you wrote it and also that you came on our podcast to talk about it. So thank you so much. And, this was amazing.
Thank you so much, Lisa. It's been a pleasure talking to you.